Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is going to be a weekly docket where I give you a rundown of all the headlines in true crime this week. I've got 9 or 10 stories for you guys today, so this might be a bit of a longer episode, although I did try to kind of condense the stories a little bit to just give you like surface level information of what you guys really need to know about each story. Some of these were actually stories that were requested to me on my Instagram. So if you don't already follow me on Instagram, go to mama.mysterypodcast on Instagram. You can follow me there. You can also recommend stories on mamamystery.com. Now, without further ado, we're going to get into the first story, which is an update in the Emmanuel Harrow case. So the father of baby Emmanuel Harrow, Jake Harrow, has been sentenced to more than 30 years in state prison after pleading guilty to second-degree murder in the case of his infant son, Emmanuel. Jake Harrow received a combined sentence of 25 years to life for assaulting a child under 8 and 7 years and 2 months for probation violations and related charges. The sentences will run consecutively. The tragic case began this past August when Emmanuel, who was just 7 months old, was reported missing after his mother claimed that he was abducted from a parking lot in Yucaipa. Investigators later determined that no kidnapping took place. I think anyone who saw her interviews kind of knew something was off about this whole story from the very jump. But they believe that Emmanuel had been abused over an extended period of time and that his death resulted from those injuries. Harrow's criminal history also played a significant role in the case. Court records show that in 2023, he pleaded guilty to willful child cruelty involving his infant daughter, who now suffers permanent disabilities, including cerebral palsy. That prior case drew strong criticism since the judge granted probation rather than prison time. The district attorney's office in Riverside County called the earlier decision outrageous and blamed it for enabling the subsequent tragedy. Although Emmanuel's body has not been recovered, authorities say that they have a strong indication of the location of his remains and continue to search, but he is presumed dead. His wife, Rebecca Harrow, who is 41 years old, has pleaded not guilty to murder and remains held on bail. According to public statements and court filings, the case has raised many questions about how past child abuse cases are handled and whether earlier intervention could have prevented this outcome. And with that, I think it's a perfect segue into this next story, because we have to start holding these judges accountable in some way. And I don't know how you do that, but every time somebody gets off with a slap on the wrist, they almost always reoffend, and the reoffense is usually worse than the first one. And so I don't understand the logic behind this, but there is a judge in Stillwater, Oklahoma, who is coming under fire for this exact reason. So this is out of Stillwater. Jesse Mack Butler is a 17-year-old, and he was facing nearly 80 years behind bars after being convicted of raping and assaulting two of his high school girlfriends. One of those victims was actually left close to death after he strangled her, choking her until she was unconscious. Now, initially, he was charged as an adult with 10 felony counts, including rape, attempted rape, sexual battery, and assault. However, he struck a deal with the DA's office to change his status from adult to a youthful offender, effectively bypassing that 80 years behind bars. Now, Jesse is the son of a prominent sports coach for OSU. And he also brought his mommy and his big sister to court for extra protection, I guess, in addition to his ridiculous sunglasses, which I'll go ahead and put that on the cover art for this episode so you can see exactly who we are talking about. But the first victim told investigators that Jesse repeatedly raped her and choked her when she tried to refuse during their 3-month relationship. Her doctor said that she had to undergo surgery to repair the damage that was done to her neck after being choked, and that she would have died if the choking lasted another 30 seconds. The judge in this case is Susan Worthington, and she allowed him to accept this deal that, you know, changed his status to a youthful offender. Effectively, now he doesn't have to serve any prison time for this. There are a lot of people in Stillwater who are very upset. They were showing up to the courthouse in droves on the front yard or front lawn of the courthouse, essentially protesting, because a lot of people are upset that this kid is not going to be held accountable. And so I also shared it on my Facebook page if you want to go see the full post of that. But let's go ahead and share this kid's face and make sure that everyone knows exactly who he is and make sure nobody forgets his face or what he did to these girls. Now for the next story, we're moving to Louisville, Kentucky. This isn't really a true crime story, but I think it's just such a heartbreaking and wild story, I guess. On Tuesday evening, November 4th, around 5:15 local time, a cargo aircraft operated by UPS Airlines flight number 2976 lifted off from Louisville Muhammad Ali International Airport in Louisville, Kentucky, destined for Honolulu. The aircraft, a McDonnell Douglas MD-11F, had three crew members on board. Moments after takeoff, witnesses say that the engine of the left wing caught fire. The plane managed to climb a bit. I think it was only about 75 feet. Before it plunged sharply into the ground and crashed into an industrial area that was near the runway. Flames and thick black smoke immediately filled the sky. The explosion was huge. The aircraft struck two nearby businesses, one of them being a petroleum recycling facility and the other being an auto parts store. And you have to think, for a plane to be filled with so much cargo and then also so much fuel to get them from Kentucky to Honolulu, Hawaii, it kind of explains why the explosion was so big. Governor Andy Beshear later announced that the death toll had risen to 9 people, including the 3 crew members on board. At least 11 additional people were injured, some seriously, and I think there are some people who are also still unaccounted for, so those numbers could rise. Local authorities issued a shelter-in-place order in the vicinity of the airport and evacuated or restricted access to the crash zone due to hazards from the debris and the fire itself. In the aftermath, operations at the UPS hub known as Worldport, one of the company's largest air cargo facilities, was suspended. The hub processes hundreds of flights daily, and the disruption began to ripple outward with people seeing delays in their packages or their shipments. Investigators from the NTSB, or the National Transportation Safety Board, and the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, are on site. Early signals suggest investigators will examine that left-wing fire, possible engine separation, which I think is because the engine actually fell out of that capsule that it's usually in underneath the wing, because there are pictures of it sitting on the ground, and it looks like it somehow became dislodged during takeoff. They're also going to be investigating the fuel load and possible structural issues with that plane. Now, this next story hits close to home because it's something that I'm trying to advocate against, which is having kids on Snapchat. A 13-year-old girl from Baker, Louisiana, disappeared around October 20th of 2025 after connecting with a 26-year-old man, Keyshawn Crumity, on the social media platform Snapchat. He allegedly told her he could help her arrange for her to be adopted by a trusted adult. Within days, the teenager left home and traveled. Investigators followed her trail from Louisiana to Georgia, then to Washington, D.C., and ultimately to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In the basement of Keyshawn Crumity's home in the Brighton Heights neighborhood, they found her hiding inside a sheet-covered box. According to court documents, once she arrived there, the girl shared a bed in the basement with Keyshawn and another woman. She told law enforcement that she was given alcohol and marijuana edibles. Over the week that she was held, she alleged that Keyshawn sexually assaulted her 1 or 2 times each day. Officials with the U.S. Marshals Service, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and Pittsburgh Bureau of Police executed a search warrant on October 30th. Keyshawn was arrested and charged with multiple counts, including human trafficking of a minor, sexual assault, unlawful contact with a minor, and corruption of a minor. Bail was denied. In addition to Crumity's arrest, 2 other men were also taken into custody. 62-year-old Ronald Smith was arrested in Georgia on a charge of simple kidnapping and contributing to the delinquency of a juvenile. Another man, Alvin Hansen, was arrested in New Orleans for similar charges. Authorities say that more arrests are expected as the investigation continues. The girl was taken to a hospital after her rescue, where it was confirmed that she had been sexually assaulted. She later told authorities that the hospital felt like, quote, the safest she had ever felt, end quote. Now, obviously, this case highlights how grooming and exploitation via social media platforms can lead to interstate trafficking of minors. Now, this is something that I have been talking about, and it's a great segue into a project that I have started called the Uncool Collective. And after this episode, I hope you will go listen to the episode that I publish announcing essentially what that collective is. Austin and I sat down together to discuss what our plans are and what our motives are for this project. So I hope that you will listen to it. And I hope that you will really take it seriously when it comes to your kids having phones in their hands. Next, we're going to talk about a requested story, which is the Abby Zwirner trial. On January 6th at Richneck Elementary School in Newport News, Virginia, a first grade teacher, Abby Zwirner, was teaching her students when a six-year-old boy pulled out a handgun from his backpack and shot her. The bullet passed through her left hand and lodged in her chest. She survived, but the damages to her body and life were profound. In the courtroom in 2025 now, this is currently happening, Abby is suing the former assistant principal, Ebony Parker, for $40 million, alleging that Ebony Parker ignored multiple credible warnings that the student had brought a gun to school that day. According to the lawsuit, at least four separate staff members alerted Ebony Parker that morning. A reading specialist reported hearing classmates say that the student had a gun. Abby saw him take something from his backpack and put it in his pocket, and others raised concerns about his behavior. But despite those warnings, Abby's attorneys say that Parker did not remove the student from the classroom, did not search him, and failed to call law enforcement before the shooting. In her testimony, Abby described the aftermath of the shooting, saying, quote, "I thought I had died. I thought I was either on my way to heaven or in heaven," end quote. Medical testimony confirmed she required six surgeries, suffers from lasting damage to her left hand, and still has the bullet lodged near her heart. Her twin sister described how her sister's life has changed, how she no longer goes out, how her light has kind of dimmed, and how the teacher that she once was may be gone. The trial is focused on negligence and foreseeability. Ebony Parker's defense argues that decisions made in a school setting are collaborative, that the risk of a six-year-old bringing a gun was unforeseeable, and that hindsight should not influence the jury's view. Meanwhile, the student's mother was previously sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison for federal weapons and child neglect charges. I also think it's worth noting that this kid has had a long rap sheet, if you will, within the school of disruptive and violent behavior. So the fact that this was unforeseeable is a bit of a stretch, in my opinion. Now, for Abby Zwirner, the lawsuit is more than financial. It's about accountability, safety in schools, and preventing such a moment from happening again. And her story raises sharp questions about how schools respond to risks, how early warning signs are handled, and what protections exist for educators in volatile situations. I have a nagging suspicion that this is only going to continue to get worse, because we have a lot of teachers who are really struggling. They can barely afford to live on a teacher's salary. They are being bombarded with huge class sizes, and the class sizes beyond that, the actual like kids in the class are of various levels of ability. So especially because of the COVID pandemic, when we had a lot of kids doing virtual schooling, a lot of kids were left behind, and you're trying to catch those kids up. We've got kids with a wide array of behavioral issues, and schools are really limited in what they can really do, or at least teachers, I believe, are really limited in what they can do, because a lot of these states depend on state funding, and if you don't have kids in the school, then you don't get funded for that school. So you see a lot of these kids who probably deserve to be expelled, and yet they get to hang around a little longer. And I feel like a lot of it is because of bureaucratic issues, but I fear that until we see something drastic change for the better in our education system, this will not be the last story like this. this next story is another one that was highly requested, and it's regarding a missing girl named Melody Buzzard. In early October, authorities in Santa Barbara County, California, began investigating the disappearance of 9-year-old Melody Buzzard, who lived in the Vandenberg Village area near Lompoc. Melody's absence came to light when the Lompoc Unified School District notified the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Office that
Have you heard of Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth? It's the supplement designed to help women maintain optimal hormone levels. With more than 50,000 glowing reviews worldwide and 98% of women saying that they would recommend it to their friends and family, it's clear why it's such a fan favorite. And now you can take those results even further with their prebiotic collagen protein. This product is all about supporting your gut health, which directly impacts your hormones. When your gut is in balance, it can really amplify the benefits of hormone harmony. So here's what it helps with. It helps with relieving occasional bloating and gas, check. Reducing sugar cravings so you feel satisfied longer, definitely need that. Supporting healthy, sustainable weight management, which is something I have always struggled with. And boosting energy and supporting general well-being. Again, I think all moms can probably relate to basically all of those symptoms. But personally, I've noticed that adding prebiotic collagen protein to my routine made a big difference. It's given me more energy during the day and just an overall feeling of balance. Like I'm not on this wild roller coaster of hormonal imbalance. And what I really like about Happy Mammoth is their commitment to quality. Their products are inspired by nature, but backed by science, and they never cut corners. Right now, you can try prebiotic collagen protein and hormone harmony risk-free and get 15% off your entire first order with the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, at checkout. Just go to happymammoth.com and use the code MAMA for 15% off today.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Gold Belly. Gold Belly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Gold Belly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Melody was enrolled in an independent learning program in August, but had not picked up her assignments and had effectively been missing from any educational check-in since then. Surveillance footage captured Melody and her mother, Ashley Buzzard, on October 7th in Lompoc at a car rental agency. They rented a white 2024 Chevy Malibu with initial California license plate 9MNG101. In that footage, both mother and daughter appeared to be wearing wigs, Melody's wig looking darker and straighter than her natural curly brown hair. And over the next few days, detectives believe the pair traveled as far as Nebraska, then returned with the Malibu seen on October 8th, bearing a New York plate HCG9677, a plate not matching the vehicle or Ashley. So investigators say the switch was likely done to avoid detection. On October 9th, surveillance video placed Melody in the region between the Colorado-Utah border as part of the return route. Then on October 10th, Ashley returned home to Lompoc without Melody. From that moment, her whereabouts became unknown. Investigators officially launched a missing person probe on October 14th after the school district raised concerns. Melody is described as about 4'6" tall, weighing around 60 pounds with brown curly hair and brown eyes. Because of the wigs and disguises that were seen on surveillance footage, authorities say her appearance may be altered in recent imagery. And a lot of people have commented that the main picture that has been floating around, and I'll put it on the cover art of this episode, does appear to be a younger Melody. But unfortunately, there aren't any other updated pictures of what she would look like currently. And like I said, that could change depending on what disguise she could be using. Now, the urgency is high here. Melody is considered an at-risk missing child due to her young age, the length of absence, and the apparent interstate travel. As of now, her mother has been uncooperative with investigators. No charges have been publicly announced in relation to Melody's disappearance, and the investigation spans multiple states with law enforcement agencies in Colorado, Utah, Arizona, Nevada, and California working together and requesting any surveillance footage or witness contacts from the October 7th to 10th road trip timeline. The public has been asked to help anyone who may have had contact with Melody or her mother, or who has surveillance footage capturing their travel, should contact the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Office tip line. Next, on Tuesday evening, October 28th, a 51-year-old woman in the suburban Twin Cities area of Vadnais Heights, Minnesota, was out for her routine walk talking on her phone with her headphones in. As she neared the curb, the comfort of that familiar stroll was shattered when a man described in court filings as 6'8" tall and weighing nearly 250 pounds allegedly stalked her from behind and then shoved her off the sidewalk into the grass. In the attack that followed, the suspect grabbed her, used one hand to cover her mouth, and pressed his forearm against her neck, making it difficult for her to breathe. She believed that she was going to die. Her headphones and phone fell to the ground during the assault, and at one point she managed to bite his hand. Despite the trauma, she fought back and cried for help. Responding officers found the victim's shoes, headphones, and the attacker's glasses near the scene. The glasses actually became a key piece of evidence when the suspect's family realized the glasses were missing and contacted law enforcement. The suspect was identified through DNA evidence and was arrested on October 30th. The accused is Tristan Allen Laritz, who is only 21 years old from White Bear Township, Minnesota. He has been charged with first-degree criminal sexual conduct in Ramsey County. Upon his arrest, Tristan allegedly told investigators that his actions stemmed from frustration over being a virgin. This case highlights just the importance of vigilance. Every time I end an episode saying, stay curious, stay vigilant, this is, you know, the kind of stuff I'm talking about. The victim's bravery in that moment, the presence of nearby witnesses, even though cars drove by without stopping, and the quick action by law enforcement all contributed to her not only being alive, but a suspect being taken into custody. So for my listeners and followers of this show, it is just a stark reminder of how vulnerable everyday routines can sometimes become deadly. So please stay curious, stay vigilant. If you're ever out walking by yourself, you've got to keep your eyes peeled for whatever lurks around you. And I don't say that to say that you should live in a state of fear. It's just you need to be aware of your surroundings all the time, especially if you are a woman. Next, early on the morning of Saturday, November 1st, two young men are accused of turning what began as a night out into a federal crime scene. Around 2:23 a.m., surveillance footage captured 18-year-old Logan David Patterson of Plymouth, Massachusetts, and 20-year-old Dominic Frank Cardoza of Bourne, Massachusetts, walking toward the Longwood Medical Campus of Harvard University wearing dark clothes and face coverings. They reportedly climbed over a chain-link fence into a construction zone surrounding the Goldenson Building, which houses neurobiology research labs for Harvard Medical School. Surveillance then shows them climbing scaffolding and entering the fourth floor of the building. At approximately 2:45 a.m., an explosion occurred in a wooden locker inside a laboratory, believed to have been caused by a large commercial firework, a Roman candle plus a cherry bomb, apparently. Fortunately, no one was inside the lab at that time and there were no injuries, but the incident triggered alarms, left smoke and burn marks in a research corridor, and then, of course, raised serious safety and security concerns. Federal prosecutors charged both Patterson and Cardoza with conspiracy to damage a building by means of fire or explosive. The charge carries up to 5 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000, according to court documents. They appeared in U.S. District Court in Boston, were released pending trial under conditions including that neither possess explosive explosives, nor visit any Harvard campus building, and the investigation remains ongoing. This kind of reminds me of last week's story about the Louvre robbery and how these guys essentially broke into the Louvre to steal the royal crown jewels. I shared to my story the mugshots of the two suspects that they have apprehended so far. There are expected to be more arrests. But the comments did not disappoint, because the guys that did this just were not who I think anyone really expected them to be. So I will put their mugshots on our Instagram so you can see it for yourself and you can let me know what you think. But now it is time for our last story, which is a former American Idol contestant arrested in California for alleged sexual misconduct with a minor. On October 30th, 45-year-old Randy Madden, a former contestant on season 8 of American Idol, was arrested in Ventura County, California, and booked on 6 felony counts relating to alleged sexual conduct with a minor. According to court records, the alleged acts occurred between July and September of this year. The felony counts include unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor, penetration by a foreign object, oral copulation of a person under 18, luring a minor, sending harmful material, and dissuading a witness from reporting the crime. Madden appeared in court via Zoom and pleaded not guilty to all charges. He posted $100,000 bail and was released on November 4th. His next hearing is scheduled for November 13th. Now, his backstory kind of adds a little more context. He gained brief public attention in 2009 during his American Idol audition, where he sang Living on a Prayer, but did not advance through the tryouts. After a serious motorcycle accident in 2023 left him with mobility issues and multiple surgeries, he identified his occupation as disabled in jail records and was soliciting help via a GoFundMe to cover his living expenses. So how he posted a $100,000 bail is beyond me. All right, now I might have said that was the last story, but I'm actually going to add one more because this just broke yesterday. So in Phoenix, 38-year-old Christopher Ryan Schultz, the Arizona father who last month pleaded guilty in the death of his 2-year-old daughter after she was left in a hot car, allegedly while he was actually watching porn and drinking inside of the home. He said that he was playing video games, and then it later came out that he was actually watching porn. But apparently he was found dead yesterday. He was located around 5 a.m. inside a home near 7th Street and Northern Avenue. So here's a little bit of background on this whole story. On July 9th of last year, 2024, emergency crews responded to a home in Marana, Arizona, and found the toddler unresponsive in the back seat of a car. An autopsy showed her body temperature had reached 108.9 degrees, while the outdoor temperature that day reached about 109. Now, initially, Schultz told police that he left his daughter in the vehicle with the air conditioning running and then went inside the house. Surveillance later showed that the child had remained in the car for roughly 3 hours before her mother finally arrived home. His 2 other children, aged 5 and 9 at the time, later told investigators that their father had left all 3 children in the car previously, and that on that day their sister died, he was distracted playing his game and putting food away. In October of 2025, Schultz accepted a plea deal. He pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and child abuse likely to cause death or serious physical injury. The agreement carries a potential sentence of 20 to 30 years, no early release, and scheduled sentencing for November 21st. The aftermath included public scrutiny of Schultz's travel post-incident. So he was somehow permitted to vacation in Maui with his family less than a year after the child's death. And his wife also caught a lot of flack for essentially standing beside him and making excuses for him, like kind of supporting him through all of this, despite the fact that he had done this before. He had gotten in trouble before for leaving his children in the car and forgetting about them. And his wife is actually an anesthesiologist. So just there's so many layers to this story that just make it so baffling. Now, the Phoenix Police Department continues to investigate his death, but it is believed that this was likely a suicide. Now, while his death means he will not be formally sentenced on November 21st, other legal and civil aspects, such as the status of the surviving children, any child welfare agency follow-up, and any impacts on the family may still be active or remain to be seen. Now, for what it's worth, my two cents on this story is that it is incredibly tragic and senseless. This, of course, never needed to happen. But I do feel bad for the mom and the surviving two daughters in this story because they've effectively lost now two family members in pretty horrific ways. And it just goes to show that, like, one stupid decision can really ripple effect and have such a lasting impact on the people that you love. So my heart does go out to his family. That is it for today's weekly docket. And like I said, if you ever have a story that you want us to cover here on the show, go to mamamystery.com. You can scroll down to that white box and send me a message there. You can also get a hold of me on Instagram, mama.mysterypodcast. Until next week, next week, quick note, I have a deep dive that is going to be released on Tuesday, but this is going to be a Patreon exclusive deep dive. So if you want to hear this story, then you'll need to go to patreon.com/mamamystery to get that exclusive episode. And the episode is on the Dardeen family murders. This is an unsolved case. It is a horrific case. One of the more disturbing ones that I have covered. This one happened in the 80s, and this family that was living in a modest trailer home, minding their own business. They were churchgoers. They were upstanding citizens. And the mom, dad, young 2-year-old son, and the mom was actually pregnant during this attack, all lost their lives in such a horrific way. And the killer has still yet to be caught. So like I said, if you want to check out that episode, go to patreon.com/mamamystery. Until next week, have a great weekend. Stay safe, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.